Welcome. This is the Book of Genesis, an online Bible study with Dr. Joel S. Baden.
This week, we're going to be talking about really one of the most famous stories in all of Genesis, if not in the entire Bible. A story that I think traditionally or commonly called the sacrifice of Isaac, but that in Jewish tradition, at least, is called more accurately the binding of Isaac, since he gets bound but does not get sacrificed. So I'm going to refer to it, I think, probably throughout as the binding of Isaac. And you'll just know that we're all talking about the same story in Genesis 22. This is a story that involves, you know, as readers, issues of ethics, right? Divine ethics. What is it that God wants here? How do we trust a God, and how do we reckon with a God who asks such a thing? Issues of obedience, is blind obedience really what we should be going for? How do we understand Abraham's obedience? How do we understand Isaac's obedience? And obviously, it's a family story, right? A father being asked to sacrifice his child. It's a weighty, very full story. And I'm going to tell you right now, there's no way on earth that I'm going to do it justice in the next 30 to 40 minutes of talking.
Is that Mr. Justin?
No. It's Dr. Baden.
I'm going to assume that there will be plenty of questions at the end, all sorts of things that I didn't get to. It's that kind of story. I'm going to start by talking about two things that this story isn't about, I think. And in the course of those two things, I may digress a little into some larger issues about how we read the biblical text. After that, I'll get a little bit more to what I think this story is doing, or at least some of the things I see in it. But I want to start with a couple of things that this story isn't. The first thing that I think this story isn't, I do not think that this is a story explaining why it is that Israelites don't sacrifice their children. There's a very common belief that this is what we call an etiology, right? A story that explains something. An etiology for this sort of unique Israelite prohibition against child sacrifice. And the story is often held up, and this notion of like everybody around Israel was sacrificing children, but not Israel, right? Not the Bible. Look at this story. It's often held up as like one of the advances of the Bible over against its pagan, Israel's pagan neighbors. I want to take a second to talk about that kind of language and that kind of idea, the Israel or the Bible being advanced over its neighbors. This is a kind of thing that we call biblical exceptionalism, right? Not so different from notions of American exceptionalism. It's biblical exceptionalism, the idea that Israel and the Bible were better than everyone else, right? More ethical than their neighbors, more moral than their neighbors, without saying, right, more monotheistic than their neighbors. Though I might suggest that actually when we say that, we're equating monotheistic with a certain kind of morality or ethics. So it's kind of all the same thing. You can understand the rationale for those kinds of claims. Why are we like this and not like those other folks? We want there to be a reason for why we are the way that we are. This is actually not unlike the conversation we had last week about Abraham, right? Abraham, according to traditions, must have had something about him, some qualities that made him worthy. And of course, we do the same thing, maybe even more strongly, with King David, just to name someone whom I happen to have also written about. King David, who, right, is kind of not the best guy ever, even in the biblical account, but we sort of justify all of David's flaws, you know, through our tradition, right? Because he's our ancestor. So I suggest we do the same thing with sort of the Bible writ large, right? We come from the Bible. So of course the Bible's better. Of course ancient Israel is better. I want to suggest that Israel wasn't actually any better than its neighbors, or even particularly different. Whether we look at the sort of social organization of the society from, you know, the family unit all the way up through the, you know, broadest sort of hierarchical, like the monarchy, just like all of their neighbors, their cultic practices, down to their very, you know, the sacrifices that they offer, basically the same as all their neighbors, especially the ones who lived closest to them in Canaan. Adherence to one national deity, right, who is the god of our people, same as the neighbors, right? You know, the Moabites right next door, they had their national god. It was, their god was named Chemosh. Israel's god was named Yahweh. But the way they understood their relationship to their god was pretty much exactly the same, even down to the fact that at least in early periods of Israel and what we call biblical period, they weren't monotheistic in the way that we say monotheistic. You know, belief that there was only one God out there, but they were what we call monolatrous. That is, they only worshiped one deity, right? One national deity. Israel in that way and in all these other ways was basically just like its neighbors. Which isn't to say that Israel didn't have unique features. Of course, Israel had unique features. Unlike its neighbors, Israel did not have a statue of the deity in its sanctuaries, right? If you were to go into a sanctuary of any of these other deities, these other nations, you'd find statues of their gods, you know, in the central part of the sanctuary. In an Israelite sanctuary, as far as we know, you wouldn't find one. That's a substantial difference. It's also like one of the only different, like real big differences that I could come up with when I was trying to think of some. But to think about is not having a statue a sign of moral or ethical progress? I would say not really, right? We think it is only because we've sort of justified it as so, right? We've proclaimed the absence of a statue to be morally or ethically superior to having a statue. But there's no sort of like objective rationale for that, I don't think. Right, it's having a statue, not having a statue, is just a difference, right? Presumably every culture had some things that made it, you know, unique or different from its neighbors. The trajectory of religious history, right, isn't one of like winning versus losing, right? Like our monotheistic ideas won out over the polytheistic, or the no statue in the sanctuary won against the losing side of having statues in the sanctuary, right? Ancient religion wasn't like a marketplace of ideas where like the better or truer faith conquered the lesser ones. Actually, beliefs come along with people, and the beliefs we hold up as better today are just the ones that like made it. And the ones that made it are the ones attached to the people who made it, right? So why Israel and Yahweh rather than say Moab and Chemosh, right? Why do we think Israel was better and Moab not? Because Moab was wiped out and Israel happened to survive and we happened to be descended from it. Israel didn't survive as opposed to Moab because Israel had better beliefs than the Moabites. Maybe better jokes than the Moabites, unclear. But it wasn't because Israel's monotheism or Yahweh worship or lack of statues, that's not why we survived, not why Israel survived as opposed to Moab. The point is, right, this even within Israel itself, right? The Dead Sea Scroll community, if they had been the ones to survive rather than what we now call sort of rabbinic Judaism or Pharisaic Judaism, if the Dead Sea Scroll community had made it, we would all be totally different now. And we would think that they were right? The right ones. My point is, history isn't linear, progressing smoothly from point A to point Z. There's a million branches at every step, and the one that gets taken isn't taken by choice. It's all just contingent, right? And it's usually contingent on external forces. All of which is to say, at the end of this little mini lecture at the beginning that has nothing to really much to do with our text, we should stop using the language of biblical exceptionalism. Oh, there, I brought it back to the text again. Israel was an ancient Near Eastern culture, pretty much like all of its neighbors. We just happen to be descended from this particular subculture rather than from the other ones. That doesn't make it or us better, right? We just happen to be descended from the survivors, right? To say that we're better is basically like claiming superiority over the dead. Where was I? I was talking about child sacrifice. That's how I got into this. I'm going to start screen sharing now because I'm going to start putting some stuff up now. Child sacrifice. So first of all, it's not like child sacrifice was something that everyone around Israel was constantly doing. Right? Child sacrifice was not like, you know, like the weekend activity for the neighboring nations. It was, as far as we can tell, an extreme measure taken only in desperation. Why would anyone sacrifice a child in the ancient world? The simple answer is because they thought it worked. And the most remarkable example of this comes obviously not from this story, but from a story about Israel's war against Moab. I seem to be using Moab for everything today. This battle between Israel and Moab, we actually have recorded both in the Bible and in a text from Moab itself, right? One of the only texts we have in the language of Moabite or from the nation of Moab is a royal statue describing this war against against Israel. It's kind of amazing we have the thing, the evidence coming from both sides. And both versions tell basically the same story, which is Israel was winning the war, but in the end, Moab prevailed. And in the biblical version of the story, we are told that the turning point was that in a moment of almost defeat, the king of Moab sacrificed his eldest son. And the Bible tells us that it worked, right? Which is amazing, I think, to most of us. He took his firstborn son and offered him up on the wall as a burnt offering, and a great wrath came upon Israel, so they withdrew. That's how Israel lost, is because the king of Moab sacrificed his son. So whether moral or immoral, maybe the wrong categories, right? The issue with child sacrifice is, at least to some people in the biblical period, and in the biblical context, it worked, right? It was recognized as efficacious. In this way, it's actually a lot like sorcery, another thing that's kind of forbidden in the Bible in multiple places. But there are also multiple stories in the Bible, one very famous one, at least, about people using sorcery to, you know, discern the future, to speak to the dead, and it works. Right? It's not that it's forbidden because it works. So while there are indeed a lot of biblical statements against child sacrifice in both legal passages, right, laws saying don't do this, and prophetic texts that are, you know, sort of accusing Israel of this sort of thing, there's a lot of biblical statements about child sacrifice. What they all seem to have in mind is that child sacrifice is an attempt to sway the deity, right, to change the course of events, to persuade God through this, unthinkable act. To do something differently. And I wonder whether child sacrifice was forbidden, again, not because it was immoral, but because it worked. Yahweh, Israel's God, tends, as far as we can tell, not to like to relinquish control. And maybe it's that child sacrifice worked too well, right? If you sacrifice your kids, Yahweh has to respond, has to sort of accept that. And that's not okay. Alongside prohibitions, though, against child sacrifice, we also find the story of, in the book of Judges, of Jephthah and his daughter, Right, this is a story of Jephthah, who is a judge in Israel, who returns from victory in battle and vows to sacrifice the first thing that comes out of his house, which in our minds might seem like a crazy thing to do, because what else comes out of your house other than people? But we have to remember that in ancient Israel, actually, the ground floor of most houses were occupied by domestic animals. So probably assumed that one of his animals would come out of his house. But instead, out comes his daughter. And now he's vowed to sacrifice his daughter. Does Yahweh reject this because child sacrifice is forbidden? Not at all. In fact, he did to her as he had vowed. He goes through with it, Jephthah does, and sacrifices his daughter. And there's no punishment for him. There's no sense at all that it's wrong. That story in Judges is really a fable about not taking rash vows. But it's also a story in which somebody sacrifices their child and Yahweh seems to be perfectly okay with it, right? Which seems to sort of belie the notion that Yahweh rejects child sacrifice. And to come back to where I started, in our story, there is no rejection of child sacrifice either, right? Abraham assumes that Yahweh is serious when he says, take your son and offer him as a burnt offering. Abraham assumes that that's something Yahweh actually wants. And Yahweh assumes that Abraham will take him seriously and actually do it. The story doesn't say, like at the end, no one shall, and that's why no one ever sacrifices a child to Yahweh, right? They knew how to write stories with morals. This one isn't one of them. In fact, the story kind of requires that child sacrifice be okay, or at least reasonable. I'm not saying that this story condones child sacrifice, just that it doesn't prohibit it either, right? This is my point at the beginning. It's kind of just not about that, even as it uses it as a plot device. That's the first thing this story is not about. Here's the second thing this story isn't about. It's not about Jesus. Okay, Christian interpretation has read the binding of Isaac as a prefiguration of Jesus basically forever. There is so much in here that looks like the story of Jesus, after all, right? We've got a father sacrificing his son. We have the sacrifice happening on the third day. We have the wood being placed on Isaac's shoulders. We have Isaac being described as Abraham's only beloved son. We have the language of the lamb being sacrificed, right? God will see to the lamb. And Jesus, of course, is the Lamb of God. And for many interpreters, right, the fact that Isaac is in fact at the end spared is a prefiguration of the resurrection. So much there that looks like parallels. So let me go sort of big picture first. There's nothing wrong with interpreting the Hebrew Bible this way. I'm never going to be the person who tells you that you cannot read this story or, you know, Isaiah, famously, or Jonah or any number of other stories. I'm not going to ever say you can't read that as being about Jesus. Right? There's nothing wrong with interpreting the Bible this way. Everyone in a biblically oriented faith community does this kind of thing. Right? Everyone makes the biblical text relevant to their own story and their own beliefs. This is how interpretation has always worked. Right? It's not just for Christians. The problem comes not when we interpret the text this way, but when we think that this is what the text itself is or is about, right? To say that this story, like in and of itself, is about Jesus is basically to deny Judaism or anyone who's non-Christian, right? I tell my students, and I actually just did this a week or so ago in class, as we were reading Isaiah. I tell my students, Jesus isn't in the Old Testament. Jesus and the Old Testament are both in Christianity, right? That's the context in which the two are connected, right? Jesus is being in the Old Testament isn't objectively true. it's true for Christians, right? That's their context. And it's true for Christians alone. Right. To see Jesus in the text is to remove the text from its context and to put it into a new one, right? That of Christianity. And that's totally fine. That's a totally fine thing to do. Please don't stop reading that way on my account. Just be aware when we're doing it, right? That we are reading the text through a particular conscious lens, right? That is the lens of, in this case, Christianity. And that we're not then seeing the text as it truly is. Okay, let me now go one small step farther. And this step might push buttons a little bit even more. And I'm gonna go back. Why is it that the story of the binding of Isaac looks so much like the story of Jesus then? It's not because the binding of Isaac is a prefiguration of the story of Jesus. It's right, actually the other way around, right? The early followers of Jesus were, of course, Jews. And it was their task, their mission, right? In order to make this convincing, this new trajectory of their faith convincing, it was their mission to link Jesus and what they were saying about Jesus with their own Jewish heritage. Right? They saw Jesus, we all know, as the fulfillment of ancient prophecies and texts, which is to say the story of Jesus, right? The story that they told about Jesus is built on paradigms from the Hebrew Bible and on generations of its interpretation among Israelites and Jews. So it's not that Genesis looks like Jesus, it's the other way around. I don't want to go too far down that road. I just want to keep our minds like clear on this. This that we're reading for today is an ancient Israelite story from the Hebrew Bible. And interpretations that take it to be something else, Jewish or Christian, are just that, right? They're interpretations. And I just want to make sure that we're not eliding the distinction between interpretation and text. Okay, I've now gone on at length about what this text isn't. So what is it? And again, I'm not going to be able to cover everything here. It is, as the opening line tells us, a test of Abraham. But a test of what? And why? Well, based on the climax of the story, right, the moment when God intervenes, it's a test of whether or not Abraham fears God. Great. What does that mean? We often take this phrase, fearing God, as relatively metaphorical, right? We don't really mean fear. It means awe. It means respect. Basically, it means belief. I want to suggest that it might actually be closer to fear. That is, implicit in this phrase, that is, you fear God, here and I think everywhere, basically, implicit here is a threat of punishment for disobedience, right? Why on earth would Abraham do this thing, right? He's been asked to sacrifice his son. Why would he do this? Because if he didn't do it implicitly, he'd be in trouble. What kind of trouble? Well, he's been promised land and progeny, right? He's been promised all this good stuff. To not obey here would be to threaten the fulfillment of those promises. I think that's actually relatively explicit in the story itself, at least relatively on the surface. My point is, when we think about the phrase fear of God, I think we have it a little bit backward. It's not that belief is the real meaning and fear is the metaphorical expression. It's that fear is the real meaning and belief and obedience are the practical expression of that fear. Okay, so it's really a test of obedience. But now the second part of the question, why does Abraham really need to still prove himself? I mean, he's done everything from the moment God spoke to him back in chapter 12. Well, So part of the answer may come from the history of the text. Again, just, you know, briefly thinking about the sources of our Pentateuch, right? This story of the sacrifice of Isaac, the binding of Isaac. There you go. I knew I'd do it once. The story of the binding of Isaac belongs to the E source. That's the source responsible for our promise in Genesis 15 that we looked at last time. That's where we had that entire issue of trust and faith, right? That's where that one came up, where Abraham went through the whole, who on earth will be my heir, right, worry. And then God promised that he'd have his own son. Abraham believed him, and it was reckoned to Abraham's merit, right, or righteousness. Well, now we're far enough along the story, Abraham has that son. Now is when his faith can actually be tested, because God has now given Abraham the thing that he wanted. Abraham, in theory, could kind of walk away at this point. So how can God be sure that Abraham wasn't like sort of just in it for the kid? Well, here's how, right? This is the test of faith and obedience, right? I've given you the thing. Are you still going to be faithful even if I now take the thing away from you? And alongside that, there's also the broader trajectory of the patriarchal promise as it runs throughout Genesis. Story after story, and we've talked about this a bit, is about the threat to the fulfillment of the promise of progeny, right? That's what Genesis is really about. Infertility among the matriarchs, Sarah and Rebecca being taken into foreign courts, Laban withholding Jacob's potential wives from him, right? This story is part of that pattern too. All these stories exist to prove that God keeps his promises despite all obstacles. And this story, almost uniquely, is one where we have an obstacle actually created by God. This story, the binding of Isaac, is, I think, almost infinitely rereadable. And as a result, there's just all too many things that we could say about it. And instead of trying to say them all, which I obviously know I can't, I want to talk here a little bit. About why I think this story is so infinitely readable. Or to be clear, what I want to talk about is the literary nature of this story. The famous literary critic Eric Auerbach, in his famous book Mimesis, held up this story as like the paradigm of biblical narrative, in contrast, in his view, to sort of Greek storytelling, right? Homer. Greek storytelling, Homeric epics, as you know, are like full of detail, sometimes excruciating detail, right? Shields, ships, etc. Right? In Homer, I know how people are dressed. I know their appearance. I know what they say. I know their inner thoughts. Homer wants us to understand absolutely everything that's happening. That's not quite the case in the story of the binding of Isaac. We get nothing but the barest bones here. God tells Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. And Abraham just kind of like starts in on it. He hears what God has to say. And then like the next morning, he started packing up. What was Abraham thinking when he got the command, when he started packing? What did Abraham say to Isaac about it? Unknown. Even bigger question, right? I think, what was Isaac thinking? Also unknown. The gaps in the story, right? Again, not in the action of the story, but in like, not the play-by-play of what's happening, but in the color commentary, right? The gaps are just immense. There's no story here. Sorry, there's plenty of story. There's no emotion here. The narrator gives us no emotion. The characters give us no emotion. There's no explicit fear. God recognizes it, but we don't. There's no fear. There's no wonder. There's no relief expressed, right? None of the emotions you'd expect in this kind of story. And yet it's an undeniably emotional story. And for me, at least, the high point emotionally is here in verses 7 through 8. I'll read them real quick just because it'll help. They've gone 3 days on their journey, and the mountain is in sight. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, "Father." And he answered, "Yes, my son." And he said, "Here are the firestone and the wood, but where's the sheep for the burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "God will see to the sheep for his burnt offering, my son." And the two of them walked on together. Even as I read it, right, like there's no emotion expressed on the surface of the text, but I find it to be an incredibly emotional little passage. Isaac's question, right, where's the sheep for the burnt offering? You know, there's so many different ways to read that. For me, Abraham's use of "my son" when he responds to Isaac here is like heart-wrenching. It may not be apparent if you're not totally familiar with the text, but this, what we have right here, these verses are the only dialogue between Abraham and Isaac in the entire Bible. And Abraham with the "my son" is just like, it's almost too much for me. But I want to think, like, how much, as we read this, how much do we as readers need to add to make this feel real, as opposed to just like, again, the barest bones of story? We may, for example, imagine when Isaac asks the question, right, where's the sheep for the burnt offering? We may imagine him as like slowly realizing that something is amiss. Like he's looking around and he's like, something's missing here, right? We may imagine that, but that's not in the text, right? That's us as readers filling in the empty emotional spaces. And honestly, we could do that, depending on how we're feeling in any given day, in all sorts of different ways. And I will say that for me, the most poignant line in the entire story is the two of them walked on together, right? How much weight is there in just that silent walking together? This story, it stretches time. It plays with time. God makes the demand, and the next thing we know, Abraham is preparing and going. And the three-day journey, Abraham and Isaac and the servants, this three-day journey passes in between verses, right? They packed up for their journey, and then on the third day, right? That whatever's happening in there, it goes by, again, without even actually taking place narratively. But then the story suddenly stops, right, and takes the time for Abraham to leave the servants behind and instruct them to wait, and for Abraham to load the wood onto Isaac. It's like, as the story rushes toward the inevitable, it's like this small hitch in the time. All we know of the final climb, right, the 3 days journey, and then they're finally climbing up the mountain. All we know about it is this conversation, Isaac's question and Abraham's answer. So again, that also passes by, described only with this, to my mind, again, incredibly poignant moment. And once they arrive at the top of the mountain, time both hastens and slows down simultaneously. So they arrived at the place of which God had told them. After all of the preparation and the travel and the conversation between verse 2 with the instruction and here, right, suddenly we're here, we've arrived. And then it's like Abraham is going suddenly so fast. Abraham built an altar there. He laid out the wood. He bound his son Isaac. He laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Like it's like one thing after another, action after action. It's like he's rushing. Considering how, you know, all we've done so far is walk and talk. And now suddenly it's bang, 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 bang with all of this stuff. And Abraham just going so fast. But at the same time, that we want to sort of slow to stop, man. Like at the same time, the detail of the process slows everything down. It's almost like slow motion. We can see each step one by one. They travel in one big leap. But here it's like, no. He built an altar and laid out the wood and bound his son and put him on the altar, right? Even as the actions come hastening one on top of each other, by giving us all of them, it like stretches the time out. And then marvelously to me, the final bit, which is its own verse, then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son, right? That one gesture of reaching for the knife takes almost as long as all of the preparation that came before it, all of the binding and all of the building. It's as if the narrator is like making sure there's like time for God to intervene, right? Like, I'm gonna have him do this real slow. You're gonna intervene, right? Like it's you're gonna stop this. I just think it's marvelous. This really sparse, bare bones, no interiority kind of storytelling may feel simplistic, but I think as any reader of, I don't know, let's say Hemingway, as any reader of Hemingway knows, right, it's really anything but simplistic. Now, I don't think that the author of this text ever thought that we 3,000 years later, whatever, would be so engrossed in interpreting it and filling in the gaps and trying to understand the psychology of the characters. I'm pretty sure whoever wrote this would be confused by the entire idea of psychology. But the text absolutely leaves space for all of that. And I would imagine that all readers, ancient and modern alike, feel those needs, right? The need to fill those gaps, even with just sort of tone of voice. And actually, I don't have to guess that. We know from extensive ancient interpretations that that's true, right? That those gaps are being filled constantly. And in that regard, this is actually a magnificently crafted text that gives us space for all of that. And I want to close here with one tiny example of the care that has gone into the writing of this story. And a brief digression before I get into this example, I want to raise the common notion that these stories are all oral tradition. And we hear that a lot, right? These stories, this is all oral tradition. And that's probably true. Most biblical stories did start out as spoken, as oral literature, right? Tales told and retold and passed around. Traditions like the promise to the patriarchs, for example, like creation, like flood, most of the ones we've read probably started off as spoken oral traditions that eventually crystallized into written form. And I'm sure that's true of this story also, but we should be careful not to confuse the oral background of the story with the written text, right? What we're reading here isn't an oral story. It's written, it's text. And even if we can discern oral underpinnings, what we're reading is literature. The decisions made in the crafting of this story are literary ones. And this story, I think, has a real writtenness to it. So I want to keep in mind before anything else, these texts are literature. They're written to be read, and thus they are to be read as if they were written, not oral. Okay, now to the example. And for this, I'll have to do a tiny bit of teaching you of Hebrew. The word see, like to look, to see in Hebrew, is ra'ah. And the word for fear is yireh. These may sound reasonably distinctive, but the way Hebrew works, in certain conjugations, they're practically identical. So he will see is yireh, and he will fear is yira'ah. And even closer, they will see is yiru, and they will fear is yiru. They're incredibly close words. Hebrew is built on a system of roots, right? The root word see, for example, is also the base word for a word like show, right? To cause someone to see. Okay, that's the brief Hebrew background. I think that's probably enough for what I'm going to show you. And the author of this story plays with these words, see and fear, in what looks like a pretty intentional way. The word see, ra'ah, appears in the story 6 times. So one of the heights that I will show you, he saw the place from afar, God will see to the sheep. And then Abraham sees the ram And then in the last line, there's actually two in the sort of naming of the place. Abraham named the site Yahweh Adonai will see, Yireh. And then, and why did he call it that? Because they say, on the Mount of Yahweh, there is vision, sight. So six occurrences of the root word see. And right in the middle of those six, right at the climax of the story, we get the one and only occurrence of the other word, fear, Yireh. Right. So these two words that sound alike, right, that that look alike in writing, that sound alike in speaking, that can be easily mistaken one for another, right? They're sort of the fear word is right in the middle of a story that's all about sight, otherwise. Now, I'm sure we could make like some good interpretive hay out of like what is the connection between sight and fear. But I'm mostly interested here in just noticing how well made the story is. We have loved it and lived with it for all of this time, not by chance, right? It's a really good story and it's really well written. And I'm not the kind of scholar or reader who thinks that the entire Bible is all brilliantly written. I don't. There's parts of the Bible I think are like, meh, okay. But this is really good writing. Okay, one last, very last thing. We have made this into one of the central stories of Genesis and maybe the entire Hebrew Bible. But like some other stories we've read that are so important to us today, there's no indication that this story was even known to anyone else in ancient Israel. It is simply never mentioned again. It's not mentioned again in Genesis. It's not mentioned again anywhere else in the Hebrew Bible. So another reminder then that these texts aren't inherently valuable, like even in their own ancient contexts, right? We are the ones who make these texts into what they are, as readers in our own interpretive communities. Okay, that's the end of what I gotta say. Now let's see what you have to say. Can you give us an example of a biblical, somebody asked, I find some biblical text stories to be like meh in their telling. Can I give an example of one such? No, I don't want to do that. That's not very nice. I wouldn't even say it in terms of stories, though I'm sure there are some stories I could think of that aren't very well done. But, you know, I don't think all the prophets are beautifully, brilliantly written literature. Some of them I think are really wonderful. I was just teaching Isaiah the other day. And I think the first chapter of Isaiah is terrific. And then there's like a big lull, maybe all the way until second Isaiah. Like it takes a long time. The first chapter is terrific. And then I kind of like, anyway, not important. Okay. Was there a version of the story? This is a really interesting question. Was there a version of the story in which Isaac was actually sacrificed? That's not a question that comes out of nowhere. Right? Islamic tradition actually tells the story as Isaac, It's either they tell the story as Isaac was in fact sacrificed and Ishmael then becomes the inheritor of the promise, or it's Ishmael who's the one who goes up the mountain. It's one of the two. But there is a small scholarly trend of folks who try and make the argument that in an original version of this story, Isaac was actually sacrificed. If such a thing was once the case, there's just no evidence of it, right? I think it's a little bit of a like scholarly fantasy that there's some underlying secret story that we could dig up. All I know is, after this story, Isaac goes on to be the main character in the story for a whole bunch of chapters. And so like, if he died, we'd be confused by what's going on in the rest of the story. So my long story short is, I don't think there was ever a version in ancient Israel of this story in which Isaac was sacrificed. If there is, it's well, very, very much lost to us and it exists only in scholarly reconstruction. Okay. Does the binding of Isaac allude to the revelation on Sinai? Right? The reason one would think this is because the mountain that Isaac goes up is called Moriah, Something's happening with my screen. I don't know if it's happening with other people's screens. I'm viewing someone else's screen. That's confusing. Okay. It's called Moriah, and Moriah is equated in tradition with Mount Zion, actually in Jerusalem, with the site where the temple would eventually be built is understood to be that site. But in that sense, right, in the same sense that Sinai is the sort of prototype for God's, right, the mountain on which God dwells, that is Zion and other tradition, one could potentially see a connection between Isaac, this mountain, and Sinai, or this mountain and Zion. And I have to admit, I think that that's probably, again, a later interpretation of the text. I'm not I don't think this story was originally designed to be a sort of an etiology for the mountain that God's temple would be on or anything like that. But I think later tradition for sure did that kind of work. Okay. I mentioned in the video, video conversation, that Isaac was 47 years old if you follow the time sequence. I didn't mention this during this talk, but this is one of the funny things that happens when you combine different sources into one story. Reading this story, you'd really have to think that Isaac is a kid. I think it's the way it mostly makes sense. But in the very next chapter, we're told the age of Sarah when she dies. And if we calculate the age of Sarah when she dies versus the age that Sarah was when Isaac was born, it turns out that if that Sarah's death happened right after this, then Isaac would be something like 47 years old at the time of this sacrifice. Which again, I think is actually pretty silly, right? That's an age that occurs only because I took a story here where he's a kid, I think pretty solidly, and a different source that had Sarah's death happen next and jumped in time considerably. In other words, when we read it sort of canonically as a single story, we end up with what looks to me like a kind of a silly reading of the text. But we just probably should ignore that and not worry about it too much. Do we know how prevalent child sacrifice may have been in the ancient Near East? Do we know if Israel ever practiced this? We don't have evidence that it was super prevalent. And I think I was trying to say that at the beginning. It's not that they were sacrificing children all over the place. Was there some? Probably. Was there some in Israel? Also probably, and I know that in part from a story like Jephthah's, but more because there's multiple laws outlawing it. And, you know, it remains a pretty good rule that you don't need to outlaw something that nobody's doing. We seem to like, the Bible seems to tell us which area of Jerusalem was the area where child sacrifice occasionally happened. Area called the Tophet, just outside, right in the valley, just outside of out of the city walls. My guess is it happened occasionally, and I don't think that that's particularly strange. It's just, you know, very distant from us. But I think there's probably no question that it did happen with some regularity. A book that came out not so long ago on child sacrifice in ancient Israel that sort of, you know, propose that there are a bunch of distinct moments or types of child sacrifices and rationales for them. So, you know, again, basing it largely in its ancient Near Eastern context, I think there's probably pretty good evidence that was the case. Am I using the word test in the traditional sense of the word? You know, I think so. Right, Abraham does pass a test, right? But now I know, I learned something, God says. I know now that you fear God. That was the test, do you fear God or not? I think that is how I would understand test. The Hebrew word actually is a little bit broader than just that. In Hebrew, the word can actually also mean to give an experience of something. Right. So when God appears on Sinai and the people overhear him speaking with Moses, and they're like, please, we don't ever want to hear that again. Moses says, well, you know, God has only done this in order to give you this experience. In that case, the point of the experience is so that from now on, you should be afraid. You should fear God, right? So again, it's actually nicely tied up with this. Oh, whoever asked the question about like, is this sort of like the, like in Sinai? Kind of, just, I don't think, I think in Exodus 19 and 20, right? The idea of there being a proving of fear, or that's a nice connection I hadn't seen before. Let me see, what other things do we have? Why did God test Abraham? The questioner asks. God is omniscient. He knew how Abraham would respond. I like that question because in part it assumes a particular understanding of God that I don't think is biblical. The notion of the omniscient deity is simply not one that we find, I would say, almost anywhere in the Hebrew Bible, almost anywhere, certainly not in Genesis. God may know certain things in advance. There's some things that are planned, but I think it's quite clear from both, I mean, we can all go all the way back to creation in Genesis 2, where for sure none of that went the way that God expected it to. to the flood story, where God has regrets. Israel's, the God of ancient Israel, their understanding of Yahweh was not omniscient or omnipresent or even omnipotent necessarily, right? That understanding of God is really derives from, and I've said this before and it's worth repeating every time, right? That understanding of God comes out of Greek philosophical notions of how a deity, how a God would have to be. And they're not, it's just not understandings that are native to ancient Israel or the Hebrew Bible. So God actually does need to test Abraham. God actually, you know, does need to make promises and make sure they're followed through on and put in place safeguards for his own memory and that sort of thing. Omniscient is not, it's just almost never a Hebrew Bible category. Somebody said, I want to know what Sarah thought of this. She dies in the next chapter, after all. And that, right, that's a gap, a huge, whopping gap in the story, right? Which honestly, we could say about almost all of the female characters in the Bible at almost every time, right? What was Sarah thinking about anything, any of the time, right? What was Sarah thinking when Abraham was like, we're packing up and going to this random place that a God who just talked to me is gonna told me to go to, right? What was Sarah thinking? We're never gonna know. But that exact gap, right, that Abraham takes off with Isaac, and you know, Sarah has been as committed to Isaac as, you know, being born as Abraham was, and defensive about him, right? We can think about the conflict between Isaac and Ishmael, and Sarah's part in all of that. Sarah's got real attachment to Isaac. What does she think? We don't know what she thinks. She dies in the very next chapter, and there is absolutely a strand of interpretation that says she died precisely because she like learned what was going to happen and assumed that her son was about to be sacrificed, and she died of a broken heart, or however you want to sort of construct that. That's in the interpretive tradition of this story, of course. But that's, you know, what we're pointing to then. It's not even the gaps within the story. There's a whole world, right? There's an entire universe of people and actors and that are barely, if at all, described in the text. You give me an example that from our story, but with broader sort of broader implications. The first beginning, the story, Abraham takes, right, Isaac and two servants. And then there's a point where Abraham says to the servants, okay, you stay here, we'll be back. Who are these servants? And it's a slightly separate question. When we translate it as servant, it sounds okay. But the same Hebrew word is, right, slaves, right? Abraham took Isaac and his two slaves. So a slightly different valence to it. And we might ask questions like here and in lots of different stories where slaves and or servants, I like using slaves, I think it's more accurate, where slaves are sort of in the background wandering around. You know, God appears to Abraham and Abraham turns to his servant or slave and says, quick, run, right? Like fetch a lamb to slaughter. There are these characters who are there in the text who have no speech, no words, no personas, no reactions, but they populate the narrative world. And, you know, Sarah is more prominent than that, but the same holds true for her. And honestly, I think part of my point of what I was saying today was it goes all the way up the ladder, right? I don't know what the servants were thinking or ever think. I don't know what Sarah was thinking, though I know what she thinks some of the time. I don't know what Isaac was thinking in the story. I know what he's going to think more later. And I have lots and lots of texts about Abraham, and I still don't know what he thinks about 99% of the things that are happening in his world and in his life. In part, that's because the Bible isn't necessarily interested in telling us full biographies. Right? That's not what's it's not the genre. But as a result, our interpretive tradition is, you know, sort of biblical interpretive tradition is almost infinitely rich because there are just so many gaps to fill in. And this story is just such a good example of how many sort of gaps there are and how much work we do as readers. Again, I'm thinking even as I was reading the part that I said was so poignant, verse 7 and 8, I realized as I was reading that just in the tone that I was reading it in, I was gap filling, right? I was filling emotion in just by speaking it out loud. So even that very act fills gaps in a way that reading off the page doesn't necessarily. Okay, I am going to stop there for the sake of time and on the understanding that, as I said, we couldn't possibly get to all of this. You know, this is a story that is read in synagogues around the world once a year, twice a year actually, but once every year at Yom Kippur, right, the holiest day in Judaism, this story gets read, which means every year, every Jewish community produces, whether it's from a rabbi or a layperson, some new take or new, like someone's rereading this text every year, everywhere around the world for, I don't know, in the practice of reading this, at least 1500 years, I would guess, that this story has been read on this date, which is to say, there's plenty to say about it. There's plenty to say. And as I said, I couldn't cover it all. I hope the things that I covered were of interest and useful. And again, there's more in the video and in the readings, and there's just infinitely more to it.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 7.